Hey, everybody. Today is September 1st, 2012, and what I have for you coming up is an edited down version of the August 30th live show and after show combo. Edited to sound pretty much like a podcast, I think, without any of those distracting breaks. We really get to it in this one, introducing something that I think over time, and you're going to hear me talk about this plenty today on the show, could transform into something that has practical use. It's called the political debate contract. You'll hear all about it in the show today. This is going to be the next installment in our Logic Saves Lives series, even though this discussion expands beyond the realm of logic itself. Remember, critical thinking contains numerous components. We've talked many times in the past on the show about the trivium, the grammar, the background knowledge, the logic integrating that knowledge, and the rhetoric explaining it to others. But there's other ways to think about critical thinking as well, and in the first installment of the series, we had Wes Bertrand on, and we talked about the importance of the approach, the attitudes and values that you bring to this endeavor, and that is also covered in the show today in some detail. Before we get started, I just want to thank Rich, Lisa, Tony, and Kevin from TragedyandHope.com. You've actually heard Rich and Tony in this series already in the introduction. They were my guests. I was on Skype before the live show in the afternoon with them for about 2 hours going over this document, this contract for debates that I had prepared. So I wanted to thank them for their input and their time in this. And during our conversation, we talked a little bit about John Taylor Gatto. I've mentioned this a few times on the show in the past, and I just would like to keep it at the front of everyone's minds. A couple weeks after they had filmed The Ultimate History Lesson, he suffered multiple strokes, and he has been recovering ever since. And Rich and Lisa have been to see him in Manhattan a couple times, and we talked about how they are participating quite a bit in trying to make sure that he gets the help and the care that he needs. In fact, if my schedule allows, and I'm really hoping that it does, I might actually have an opportunity to go down there myself. And I know that Rich actually passed along to him some of my podcast, the School Sucks podcast, which I know you're familiar with. So that's certainly a neat thing for me to even think about. And if I do make it down there even eventually, I would certainly look forward to having a conversation with him about his thoughts on the old show here. But that's all I'm going to say about our discussion here. We did talk about this for quite a while, but obviously I want to respect this man's privacy. They are looking for a little bit of support with the recovery efforts, and I will continue from this point forward to put a link in the show notes to the John Taylor Gatto Recovery Project page on the ultimatehistorylesson.com website. ultimatehistorylesson.com/donate will get you there, and there's a chip in. They've raised about $3,000 already. So that's very positive, and I hope in the future I can be a little bit more involved in this effort than I have been so far, even if it's just through raising awareness and letting people know that there is a project, an effort underway to help John get back to where he was before the stroke. And, you know, I mean, I know I've mentioned this several times, but this is somebody who was a real pivotal figure in my development. And if I hadn't stumbled across his work on the old internet, I mean the old internet, like 8 years ago, one day while I was doing some graduate school crap, I don't know where I would be in my thinking today. I could be in a very different place. Maybe I would have gotten here eventually, but I appreciate the push from being exposed to his work at a pretty crucial time in my life. I mean, I could be teaching in public school right now. Who knows? Oh, who even wants to think about that? Okay, so thanks, everyone. Here's the show.
And then we decided to go over to this place, Crossfire, which is a nuanced public policy analysis show. That is named after the stray bullets that hit innocent bystanders in a gang fight.
Hey, Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. This is Brett. With me tonight, Corey and Osborne. And we spent the first segment of the show talking about this thing that's going on called the Republican National Convention. And we're going to have a presidential election. And people get into these arguments about politics. They're very common, very vitriolic. They're very, very unproductive. And I have to admit that I've engaged in a great, great, great many of them over the years myself. And it's something that in recent years I put a lot of thought into. Why do I want to do this? There is a sort of sport to it, but it needs to be like time spent productively, and it's not. You guys have experience with this yourselves?
Yeah, way too much. Mm-hmm. Although I've definitely positioned myself to where I don't have to have those conversations anymore because I just avoid those people.
Now, that's an interesting... And how about you, Corey?
It is very difficult to have a productive conversation and feel like I spent my time well.
It's exactly how I feel, over and over and over again. And sometimes I feel like I do make headway, but if a week goes by and they retreat to their sort of safe media confirmation bias sources, New York Times, Fox News, whatever, that it's erased. It's Groundhog Day. We start from scratch the next time. So I get what you're saying. Now, Osborne, you said that you avoid those people, but prior to doing the show tonight, I spent almost a half an hour on Free Talk Live with Ian, Mark, and Michelle talking about communication and not just communication, like how you talk to people, but perception. And one of the things that I find happening is that if people isolate or tend to nestle together a little bit too much with like-minded people, the people outside of that, and this is just from my own experience, tell me if you think I'm wrong, become extraordinarily difficult to tolerate.
Oh, absolutely.
Definitely.
You know? And I'm sure you become more intolerable to those people as well, right?
I'm sure it does.
Absolutely.
Go both ways.
Yeah, I think it really does go both ways. So I think that having these conversations is very important, and talking to people is important. And, patience and practice, and also target. I hate to use a word like targeting, but there are people who are better prospects for this information, and have kind of designed a show here around that idea that they're probably under 30. They're probably in high school, or, even college students. And once a student gets into college and they have, a year or two of, Krugman-esque or, what's the woman's name running for Senate in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I know who you're talking
Elizabeth
about.
Warren-esque yes, type Daniel. Professors, they become far less permeable themselves. Mm. Now, what I wanted to do was to try and come up with a more productive way for us to have some of these discussions with political people, with status. But I wanted to jump off tonight to set the tone for what we want to do with something that's a little bit different. It actually was written by Stefan Molyneux, and it's called A Handout for Statists. This was back in November of 2007. And it's basically just a script between him and what he calls a statist, a political person, a person who accepts to some degree, or to a large degree, the use of force in an attempt to solve complex, economic, social problems. So what I thought we could do is we could read this. And Corey, would you like to be Stefan Molyneux? You don't have to do any kind of voice.
Oh, good, because I haven't been working on my Stefan
impression. He's very difficult. I tried it. He's very, very difficult to imitate. No one.
His accent is very difficult to pin down. But
exactly. But the good news is that I can do statist because I have a character.
That one?
Yeah. I think if Osborne said it, I think he knows it. This character is very progressive. Mm-hmm. His name is Larry the Liberal. He was introduced on Wheels Off Liberty, where I used him to read something that was written by a liberal person. Now, when you do a voice, I think it's important to have a visual. It's important to have some picture of where that voice is actually coming from. So Larry the Liberal is a man in his middle 40s. He has glasses. His hair is... He has a full head of hair, but he doesn't take care of it. He has a beard. It's a little scraggly.
It's not you, Corey. Okay. I see you. I see you touching your beard.
I didn't get a haircut today.
His glasses and a beard. Wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
And he's wearing a one of those sport coats with the leather elbow patches.
Oh yeah,
oh, yeah, those are good.
And he has a burgundy colored turtleneck on underneath it.
That sounds way too warm.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not really a turtleneck and it's just a dickie.
You can't tell. He's also wearing, for some reason,
it adds to the mystery.
Birkenstocks with capri pants, which is like a terrible. It's like he doesn't care how he looks, but he's got more important things to do. He's trying to save the entire planet.
Right.
From things like.
From unfairness.
The free market. Greed. Very pragmatic. Larry the Liberal, and very frustrated with other people's just failure to grasp the progressive ideas. He has 8 years of college. Now, he only has a bachelor's degree, but he's almost done with a double master's, one in environmental science and the other one in a program he designed himself about Dada.
Really?
You know what Dada is?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what
Melty
Dada
clocks.
Is. Well, Dada is something
fish
that
giraffes.
Is like accidental art, and as soon as you identify it as art, it's no longer Dada. So it's a tricky thing to get a master's in, but Larry is hard at work
right,
on
right.
that in addition to his environmental science degree. I just made all that up. But that's Larry the Liberal. And you'll tell by his voice that he's very on edge and annoyed from having to deal with people's ignorance about the truth and value of progressivism. So are we ready to go?
Sure.
All right. So I'll just read this, and then Corey will be, in this case, me. That is Stefan Molyneux.
Right.
And the other character is Statist. In the interest of efficiency, I have decided to distill every argument I've ever had with your average statist so I can hand it out to those who argue that government is voluntary. If I don't like it, I can leave. Taxation is not violence, etc. I thought this might also be of use to you because, and this is a very good point, life is short.
Tell me, do you think that violence is wrong?
Yes, violence is wrong, except in self-defense.
Agreed, except in self-defense. So tell me, how do you think that problem should be solved if we should not use violence?
Well, I think that people should become more active in government, and that government should do A, B, C, X, Y, and Z.
But how do you reconcile your objection to violence with your support of government programs, since government programs are paid for through taxation, which is coercive?
Huh? What are you talking about? Taxation is not coercive.
Taxation is coercive, since if you do not pay your taxes, you are kidnapped at gunpoint and thrown in jail, where if you try to escape, you are shot.
Oh, but this is a democracy where we choose our own governments.
Being offered a choice between two violent alternatives is not the same as being free to choose. If a store owner gets to choose which mafia gang he pays protection money to, can it really be argued that he's making a free choice? If a woman can choose between two potential husbands, but she will be forced to marry one of them, can she be said to really be choosing marriage? People can only freely choose governments if they have the choice not to choose governments.
Well, there is a social contract that binds people to their governments.
There is no such thing as a social contract. Unless they have been granted power of attorney, people cannot justly sign contracts on behalf of others. If one man has the power to unilaterally impose his will on another and call it a contract, then logically a man can steal from a woman and call it charity.
But I accept the social contract, and so do you if you drive on the roads.
First of all, your choice to honor a contract does not give you the right to force me to honor it. You can choose to buy a house, but you cannot justly force me to pay for it. If you forge my signature, I am not bound to honor the contract, and I have never agreed to a social contract of any kind. Secondly, it is true that I use government services, but that is irrelevant to the central moral question of coercion. If a slave accepts a meal from his master, is he condoning slavery?
Well, I suppose not. But still, you implicitly accept the social contract by continuing to live in a country, as Socrates argued.
Can I justly create a social contract that allows me to rob anyone who lives in my neighborhood and say that if people continue to live in my neighborhood, then they are expressly consenting to my new social contract?
Well, no, but we're talking about governments, not individuals.
Is the government not composed of individuals? Is the government not just a label for a group of individuals who claim the moral right to initiate force against others, a right they define as evil for those they use violence against? If you take away all the individuals who compose the government, do you still have a government?
Well, I suppose not. But that is beside the point. You say taxation is coercive, but I have paid taxes my entire life, and I have never had a gun pointed at my head.
Sure, and a prisoner is not shot if he doesn't try to escape. If a slave conforms to his master's wishes because of the threat of violence, the situation is utterly immoral. Does the mafia have to actually burn your shop down for the threat to be violent?
No, however, I do not accept the premise that the government uses force to extract taxation from citizens.
All right. Is there anything the government does that you disagree with? Do you agree, for instance, with the invasion of Iraq?
No, I think the invasion of Iraq was morally wrong.
Why?
Because Iraq done nothing to threaten the U.S.
Right. So it's an initiation of force, not self-defense. Now you do realize that the war in Iraq is only possible because you pay your taxes.
To some degree, of course.
If the war in Iraq is morally wrong, but it is only possible because you pay your taxes and your taxes are not extracted from you through force, then you are voluntarily funding and enabling that which you call evil. Can you explain that to me?
I pay my taxes because I'm a citizen of this country. If I disagree with the war, then I should run for office and try to stop it.
All right, so if you were against child abuse, would you voluntarily fund a group dedicated to abusing children?
Of course not.
And if you did claim to be against child abuse, and you voluntarily funded a group dedicated to abusing children, and I said that you should stop doing that, and you replied that you would not, but if someone did oppose this abusive group, they should try to infiltrate this group, take control of it, and somehow stop it from abusing children. Would that make any sense at all?
Pause. Corey, read that one more time.
And if you did claim to be against child abuse, and you voluntarily funded a group dedicated to abusing children, and then I said that you should stop doing that, and you replied that you would not, but that if someone did oppose this abusive group, they should try to infiltrate this group, take control of it, and somehow stop it from abusing children. Would that make any sense?
I guess not.
If you were against the war in Iraq, but volunteered for it and agreed to fight without a salary and spent your own money to cover all your expenses, do you understand that your position would be utterly incomprehensible? You would claim to be against something and then expend enormous amounts of time, effort, and money and resources supporting it.
Yes, that would make little sense.
Thus, do you see that your position that the war in Iraq is a moral evil, but that you are voluntarily funding it through your taxes makes no sense at all? If the war in Iraq is a moral evil, but is only enabled through your voluntary funding, then continuing to fund it is to openly admit that it is not a moral evil. If you are forced to fund the war in Iraq, you can maintain that it is a moral evil because it is the initiation of the use of force. However, the taxation that is also the initiation of the use of force against you must also be a moral evil, because you are forced to fund the initiation of force against others. Thus, either taxation is coercion, or you are the worst form of moral hypocrite by voluntarily supporting that which you call evil. Does that make sense?
I can certainly see that position.
Can you find any logical flaws in my position?
No, but I still think you're wrong.
Well, I am certainly glad that you are reading this article rather than debating me directly, because as I said at the beginning, life is far too short to waste time arguing with fools.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stefan Molyneux and Larry the Liberal. What a job. Well, I'm glad that's over. First of all, mm-hmm. because that's excruciating, and I think we've had
and familiar.
Yeah, and if I had to talk in that voice much longer, I was worried I was going to soil myself. It really puts a lot of pressure on your bowels.
Isn't there a thing like if you talk like that and then someone slaps you on the back, you'll just continue talking that way forever?
I don't know. We should try that. I wouldn't mind talking that way forever.
I would mind you talking that way forever.
Okay. Yeah. I slipped there. Okay. But I wanted to use this article as a jumping off point because this is familiar territory for a lot of us where, most of these arguments end where, and we're not, what's so frustrating to me is that
I don't even feel like I'm naturally more intelligent than a lot of the people that I'm talking to. We're not, it's not any kind of intellectual pursuit. It's like almost entirely emotional.
Right.
So why are we even entering into this emotional arena? Is there a way that we can stop it before it gets to that? We talked about these debates going nowhere, the fighting, the frustration, the strained relationships that often results. But I think what a lot of people tend to overlook is that so many of these debates have absolutely no standards.
Well, I mean, look at who our role models are, though. Look at what passes for political discourse in this country. And that you can see why our personal arguments end up taking the tack that they often do.
And that's not even just the pundits that we're talking about. These are the people who actually are like trying to be the leader of the country. They don't follow those rules either.
Or the people who are trying to impartially report on what the leaders of the country are doing. It's the same thing there.
Yes. So
we don't have any good role models for how to have discussions with people.
The point that we're trying to make is that these discussions have no rules. They have no standards. They have no guidelines. And a lot of times they're just like these flash arguments. They come out of nowhere. We don't even know what starts them, but the next thing we know, we're having them.
Mm-hmm.
So what I have developed, what I'm holding in my hand, this is a real physical thing that very soon on the website, the current website, schoolsexproject.com, I will put this up either as a PDF or a document, and I will also put it in the show notes for today so you can look at it. I have drafted a political debate contract, what we also might call a social skills contract, for honest, rational, and meaningful discussions.
I didn't sign any social skills contract.
For honest, rational, and meaningful discussions about important issues. Now, what I wanted to do first is go over the document in its entirety. So you can get a complete picture of what this thing looks like. And then after that, we'll go through and we'll flesh it out piece by piece, and we can talk about each one of the clauses. So this started as kind of a joke. This version that we're going to deal with on the show today is really geared more towards entertainment purposes because we're doing a radio show here. So this is very much a draft of this. And I think a lot of this, if you actually wanted to present this to people that you were debating, some of this would have to be toned down a little bit because there are, for comedic purposes, some jabs at the other people that you would want to avoid in a productive discussion. So
yeah, that kind of goes against the spirit of the thing you're trying to do, which is to establish rules of civil discourse, right?
Absolutely. Now, this contract could actually have some educational value, even if a potential statist opponent didn't agree to its terms and wouldn't sign it. Maybe it would be a far more valuable experience instead of having another pointless debate that you just spend that time instead going over the guidelines of what makes an effective persuasive argument.
Right.
And they might say exactly what we were talking about, politics. Oh, I've never followed these rules in any discussion that I ever had, nor have I ever seen anyone on television do that either. So the first thing on the very first line that you see is that there is a topic, right? The first thing we do is we would put in a topic. And this is because all parties agree to avoid red herrings. And what a red herring is just a diversion off track, right?
False lead.
Right. Okay. So clause number one, and I'm going to try to get through the whole thing as quickly as possible, and then I said after that we'll break it down. Clause number one, clarification of purpose. Before proceeding, all parties must communicate the goals they are trying to achieve through this argument or conversation. More importantly, all parties must identify the intellectual or emotional needs they are trying to have met through such an interaction. Clause number two, ethical and logical consistency. Because almost all political arguments grow from the need of all parties to determine right from wrong or moral from immoral, each party must articulate a clear foundation of principles or axioms upon which all of their political positions are built. For example, I am a Republican/Democrat/Libertarian. You could circle one. And the political belief system that I hold is built upon the impenetrable idea or ideas that blank. And you can insert your principles here. So for libertarians, it would be something like the non-aggression principle. Mm. Please avoid abstract language and subjective claims like America is the greatest country in the world, or freedom is the answer, or Obama says ... All of your subsequent arguments and statements must not contradict the principles you put forward at this step. All elements of your current political belief system must be consistent with these principles. Clause number 3, avoiding the box. While the discussion must stay on the agreed upon topic, all parties must also agree to abstain from the tactic of putting their opponent or opponents, quote, in a box. This refers to attempts to control the context of the discussion in a way that is advantageous to you. Examples of this would be lifeboat scenarios, straw man fallacy, loaded questions, which I also call trap setting, or special pleading, which I also call the retreat. And we'll talk about all those things when we come back to this. Clause number 4, the foundation of facts. All parties must be able to demonstrate that their opinion, claim, or call to action is built upon a foundation of facts with which their opponent agrees. This is often the most challenging part of any debate because each party will have different strengths and deficits in his or her knowledge base. Both parties will agree to fact-checking in real time. That's the internet. A lot of people don't like it when you pull out your phone and say, let me Google you on that. The internet, if necessary. Number 5. Ideological flexibility. If you agree that your opponent can clearly demonstrate that your argument contains numerous inconsistencies, contradictions, or other general errors in reasoning, you will follow up by doing all of the following. Number 1, avoid launching into an emotion-driven invective against your opponent, including ad hominem attacks, aka fight. 2, avoid the taking my ball and going home tactic, where you say something like, I've had it with this. There's no talking to you. And besides, everyone is entitled to their own opinion anyway. Goodbye. AKA flight. 3, admit that your position needs additional research and consideration. 4, agree to consume 2 pieces of educational media chosen for you by your opponent, including articles, book excerpts, videos, podcasts, etc. Some examples of common errors in reasoning to avoid: the appeal to emotion or fear, the appeal to authority, popularity, circular reasoning, ambiguity, equivocation, the genetic fallacy, the fallacy of composition and division, fallacy of the excluded middle, and the appeal to tradition. And we have introduced the political debate contract, something that you could actually physically present to a person the next time one of these very unproductive and vitriolic political debates is about to erupt. You could say, hey, wait a minute. And it's not just like, here's a form you need to fill out, sir.
Right.
This is binding to both parties. Everybody has to agree and everybody has to follow these rules. So now I thought it would be important to go through clause by clause and talk about them in a little bit more detail. So the first and the most important thing is the topic or the question that all parties to agree to avoid red herrings.
Mm.
And red herrings are, it's a logical fallacy where somebody deliberately diverts away from the question that was really asked. It's very common, not just in these presidential debates, but you see pundits do this on television all the time. And the red herring can lead into other fallacies too, like to Corcoray, where somebody says, you do that too, you know, or so, you like Ron Paul. So there's the guilty by association and he did this one time. So fallacies have a tendency to build on top of one another, more like a snowball effect. And a discussion can quickly spiral out of control if you don't catch them and stop them, which is very difficult to do once a discussion becomes emotionally charged. So the first thing is the topic or the question.
Having it written down right at the top of the page helps drag you back onto track.
Yeah, and that way, if people stray away, you can actually hold it up and say, hey, look, this is what we're supposed to be talking about right here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not supposed to be all over the place. Because we've all had the discussions that where we start talking about universal healthcare and 15 minutes later, somehow we're talking about the Korean War. Right? That's not what we want to have happen. That's just a cluster F.
Right.
It seems like that might keep a conversation from naturally evolving as a conversation should.
Well, no, but I think there's a difference between evolution and spiraling out of control.
Yeah.
And if you, like an evolution of a conversation, I totally agree with what you're saying, but the evolution of a conversation would involve an issue coming to a resolution before more issues are just jammed into the conversation and it starts to fork off in all different directions, where at every step it allows people to get angrier about another issue where then their anger goes up, their anxiety goes up, their frustration goes up. And this could be for, you know, us or whoever we're arguing with. And then a new topic is introduced and it's a new opportunity for all those things to happen again. So I think identifying a topic and pointing out what a red herring is and saying, look, we really should bring this topic following the rest of these clauses to completion before we move on to anything else.
Maybe write that one down to get back to later.
That's a great idea. I was talking to the guys from Tragedy and Hope today. We were on Skype for about 2 hours, which was not on purpose. And that's great. If you have time to do that, that's great. But I was on the phone with them for 2 hours. And, it's real helpful in those conversations because everything you say, could lead to a 45-minute discussion about something else. So, just to say, oh, make a note of this and let's come back to here and let's talk about this again before we move on.
These kind of conversations often end up being the kind that instead of evolving, they just mutate.
Mm-hmm.
Not into any beneficial form. But I think this could really be helpful with that tendency.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, a lot of people might not go for this, but that's the good thing about each one of these clauses. Our time is valuable, and each clause is in itself basically an escape clause, right? Because if a person says, I don't agree, that's dumb. I'm not talking about what my needs are for this conversation. I'm not talking about what my goals are. My goal is to make you look like an idiot in front of everyone at the party.
Right.
Great, you don't have to go on to clause two. So clause one is the clarification of purpose. Before proceeding, all parties must communicate the goals they are trying to achieve through this argument or conversation. More importantly, all parties must identify the intellectual or emotional needs they are trying to have met through such an interaction. This is never done.
No.
And I think that this is something that I spent a lot of time overlooking in my own interactions with people.
I think it could be really helpful just having that clause there. People don't usually think even about what their own goals are when they get into one of these conversations.
No.
People don't consciously think about what their goals are. And most of the time, your goal is to either, like it says, come out of it with your own worldview still intact, or even better, to tear down the other person.
Exactly. Yeah. Is this an information exchange? Is this supposed to be productive and mutually beneficial? Or is your goal to escape this conversation believing all of the stuff that you believed when you fell into it?
Right. Because if that's your goal, you can just carry on believing what you already believe and we don't even have to have an argument about it.
Absolutely.
It saves us both time.
Absolutely. Moving on to number two. This one, I kind of feel like this one needs a little work. And like I said, this is a draft. This is something that I want to put out there. You know, if you have a way that you could modify this or preferably streamline it, because it is a full page and it could be a little shorter. It could be simplified. If you could modify it to the situations you find yourself in personally, please do that. Please, throw it up on our Facebook page. Send it to me in an email or just take it and use it however you want. But I think this, even though, like I said, I thought of it as a joke, I think this ultimately might have some practical value. Number two, ethical and logical consistency, the second clause. Because almost all political arguments grow from the need of all parties to determine right from wrong or moral from immoral. And even if it's just like I'm right and you're wrong. Each party must articulate a clear foundation of principles or axioms upon which all of their political positions are built.
Right.
There is time for you to join our conversation tonight. The number is 843-JOIN. SSP, you can Skype in School Sucks Live. We actually have a gentleman on Skype right now. His name is Travis. Are you there?
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Brett.
Good. You wanted to just jump back to the first clause that we were talking about. You had some thoughts about clause number one, the clarification of purpose, specifically the needs that people are trying to get met. And you wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about nonviolent communication.
Certainly. I was very pleased to hear that you brought that up. I think that's a good starting point with any conversation, just to set the tone set the tone right. Where it's not going to be this argumentative, bickering kind of tone. It's okay. You know, I'm here to address your needs. I care about you. I want to see that you're pleased in this conversation as well. I want to address what my needs are. It's this ground point that you're having here with this person that, okay, we're going to speak about things that we both mutually care about. We're addressing our needs, and those things are just set the tone right in any conversation.
But the question is, too, like when you say, I care about you, and you might care about the person very much, but right. Often these conversations are infused with resentment because from my experience, you know, like most of the people that I have really gotten into it with are baby boomers. And it's hard to see people we care about gleefully supporting things that will ultimately hurt other people, right. i.e. the younger generation, who we also care about. I have gone into several rants about my problems with baby boomers and their beliefs. And even though it's hard to collectivize or generalize an entire generation, most of the people that you talk to from that age group really seem to retreat from what could have been a pretty big wake-up call in the 1960s through the Vietnam War protests, the civil rights movements, the assassinations of three of the most pivotal figures. You know, let's not get crazy here, but all by crazed lone gunmans at very convenient times for the establishment. So, I mean, there was, even if we just stick to what people are comfortable with, which is the civil rights movement happened and the Vietnam War protests happened, this generation retreated from that kind of a wake up, in many cases, that involvement, to waving a John McCain sign by 2008. And it's kind of, it's sad that that happened. So not to stray off course too much, Travis, but there is more to it than just, I care about you, right? Like there could be, especially if these conversations have gone on again and again over the course of time, like for years, there could be some resentment built up as well.
Right. Certainly. I mean, you know, at one point, you know, my parents' generation, certainly of that generation in the 60s, you know, perhaps they were radical at one time, you know, but I think ultimately, you know, it's being respectful of what they've come to, you know, perhaps they've been, their mind has just been manipulated this whole time, or they haven't come across any really genuine media. You know, it's all been manipulative media over the past how many ever years that may be. So taking, you certainly must take that into consideration as you're speaking with anyone. So I think, you know, I say, you know, I care about you. You're my friend. And that just kind of sets the tone and to where you're basically, I don't want to say accepting of what they say, but it's just you're coming from the perspective that, you know, you're taking those things into consideration. Like you said, I mean, they've experienced certain things and maybe they have not had access to the best, most credible forms of media. So you have to take all those things into consideration, certainly when you're speaking with them.
I think it's also important that we don't pat ourselves in the back too hard for not thinking the way the people we're arguing with think. I mean, we were all subject to the same training, you know, and the same everything all our lives. And, you know, most of us at one point were right where they are, arguing against, you know, a stateless society.
And another thing that's important too, and I mean, I can't speak for everybody on this, but, you know, my personal lives in the past has certainly had some disastrous zones in it. And I think that if I was to be properly introspective, that I should be a little bit more empathetic. Sometimes it's easier to not confront reality. Sometimes it's easier to run away from something that is hard to deal with. And a lot of the political mythology provides that for people. And you can see, like I said earlier, you can see how, just like a person's
their anxiety about personal issues, their fear about personal issues, it gets wrenched up when they're forced to look at them. I think when you try to confront people who are very comfortable with some kind of, you know, nationalistic or religious mythology, that's very upsetting. And I don't think it should be like, oh, well, you're just old and dumb, you know, because we should realize, like, I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but I've screwed up plenty in my life. And I've told myself, you know, different stories and avoided problems that I should have dealt with. So, like, it's obviously politics is harm on a much larger scale, but it shouldn't be from an emotional standpoint. I shouldn't act like I have no idea what they're going through.
Right. And this is a good lead in actually to speak about nonviolent communication. You mentioned that earlier, you know, the NVC, just to read basically definitionally what it's about. I mean, it says that the NVC is based on the idea that all human beings have the capacity for compassion and only resort to violence or behavior that harms others when they don't recognize more effective strategies for meeting needs. Habits of thinking and speaking that lead to the use of violence, both psychological and physical, are learned through culture. NVC theory supposes that all human behavior stems from attempts to meet universal human needs, that these needs are never in conflict. Rather, conflict arises when strategies for meeting these needs clash. So essentially, you know, we're all trying to fix these needs. We've got these universal human needs basically just stemming from our ability to live, you know, and sustain our livelihood. So in that sense, you know, there are these universal human needs. And so ultimately, basically, NVC boils down to that we've all got livelihood. We all have to have needs met. And so it's how do we meet these needs to where everyone can be pleased? And so it's essentially convincing these people that violence is not appropriate way to meet those needs.
Absolutely. Travis, thanks for inserting that into this conversation. I think it's very important. And we are going to jump right back into the second clause of our political debate contract. And this is ethical and logical consistency. If you're just joining us, I've introduced this idea, started as a joke, but it's something that I think with a little bit of refinement might actually become useful in the real world. And we will talk about that a little bit more at the end of the show. But the second clause is ethical and logical consistency, because almost all political arguments grow from the need of all parties to determine right from wrong or moral from immoral. Each party must articulate a clear foundation of principles or axioms upon which all of their political positions are built. For example, I'm a Republican, Democrat, or a Libertarian, and that political belief system is built upon the impenetrable idea that blank. So insert the principles there. Insert the principles that all your Republican beliefs, that all your Democratic beliefs, that all your Libertarian beliefs are based on. And before the argument progresses beyond this point, remember, this can be a real time saver, and every clause provides an escape from this discussion, right? Once you talk about and get honest with yourself about why you want to have interactions like this, you can leave at any time, and you shouldn't waste your time or anybody else's time, and you shouldn't, you know, force them into having a meltdown if, you know, they're 72 years old and they're just going to vote for Republicans for the rest of their lives. It's just one person. They might be somebody you know, might be somebody you care about, but there's lots of other much better prospects for your argument.
So the idea that these principles being articulated in this section are going to be ones that cannot be changed as a result of the conversation.
Right. People should also avoid abstract or subjective claims like, my principle is America's the greatest country in the world, okay? That's entirely subjective.
Yeah.
Right? And it's extremely abstract. Greatest what? Economically, greatest quality of life over 65, greatest education system.
Almost 100% of the time stated by people who've never visited another country.
Well, it seems like that could be a valid principle to stick into the section, right? Like, So you're saying that America is the greatest country in the world. Are you saying you will never change that idea, no matter what we talk about right now?
Okay.
And then we can vacate the conversation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's true. But it should be something that's axiomatic. And a person, like, if a person doesn't know the difference between objective and subjective statements, and a person doesn't know the difference between abstract and concrete language, that means they might not be a good prospect. But there's another out at this point as well, besides what their principles are, because you should agree. I mean, before you get into the minutia of politics and you're just talking with people, like, and you don't know they're a Republican or Democrat, they're probably both going to agree when they're sitting at the, at a bar together, like, oh yeah, property taxes, my goodness, they suck. Or these bureaucrats, they're so stupid. And until that happens within the context of a Republican versus Democrat conversation, people will probably find that they agree on a lot more than they think they do. In fact, people agree on a lot of things. And one of the things I was talking about on Free Talk Live tonight is how politics is just a bad way to introduce your ideas to people, because politics is about anger and it's about aggression and it's about pitting one person against the other.
Everybody agrees that the government is the problem. Most people just disagree on which half of the government
exactly,
is the problem.
Exactly. They don't just see that it's one thing. So when you assert your principles as whatever you want to call yourself, an anarchist, a voluntarist, a libertarian, philosophical libertarian, and number one is the non-aggression principle. Now, most people, from my experience, will agree with this.
Right.
To be the first doer of force is wrong. And then they try to find other escapes after that. But if a person says, no, you know, I kind of like being the first doer of aggression, well, you're not, why would you ever talk to somebody like that?
Right.
You know?
They're probably just going to punch you.
You need to put as much distance between yourself and that person as possible, to protect yourself.
Yeah. I've tried to say this, like, if you accept aggression in your public life and you think it's effective in your public life, why don't you do it? Why don't you try it in your personal life? Why don't you punch your way through a line at the bank? You know,
right.
But that's because they're not the controllers of the aggression. If you punch your way through a line at the bank, somebody is going to you initiate.
That's an unlicensed use of aggression.
Right, right. You don't have a social contract with the people in line in front of you at the bank.
But why
that you
don't
can punch
you?
Your way
but
through
if you
them.
Say you do, then you
yeah,
do.
If you. That's all it takes to have a social contract. You just say you have a social contract.
I wonder now.
By standing in front of me in line at the bank, you agreed to my social contract wherein I kidney punch anyone standing in front
of
me.
Or maybe it's that, like, if there's 10 people in line at the bank, what you need to do is go get 10 or 11 other people from outside and bring them in with you.
Ooh, a democracy.
To push your way. Then it's a social contract.
Or get the people standing in between you and the first person in line to all agree that the first person in line shouldn't have the advantage of being first in line.
Maybe most people, like, they wouldn't even be on their toes, and you could just say, could I have everyone's attention for a minute? I'd like to form a social contract with you. And they'd say, oh, sure, yeah, that's nice. And then you punch.
Yep.
Right.
As soon
then
as
you
they
just
say
start
yes,
punching when they say yes,
just start swinging.
Yeah. No. See these kinds of things only work in this. So these are things that all have to be ironed out at other points in this discussion. So if somebody won't agree to the non-aggression principle, if somebody doesn't agree to the idea, however you word it, of self-ownership, that no one has a higher claim to your life or property than you, that property rights are real, like we skipped over a bunch of so the stuff that we maybe should have gone into a little bit more detail about critical thought in general, because when I talk about all these different outs that people try to find for themselves, you know, there are a variety of aspects to this exercise of critical thinking. Logic is part of it. The way you argue is another part of it. The background knowledge that you have is another significant part of it. The rhetoric you use, the rhetorical trickery, the logical fallacies, the attitudes and approach that you bring to that conversation. So one of the reasons why I thought this was valuable is that one of the most successful political conversations I ever had with a person was when I went out to my car and I went into my bag that I use for tutoring and I got my dry erase board
and I started to draw visual representations of our ideas. The conversation couldn't be all willy-dilly anymore. Right. There was something concrete. There was something that was grounding us that we were able to focus on. And that actually changed things. I ruined it the next night with the same person when I said that the U.S. government was a greater danger to the world than Al-Qaeda. The night before was great. The night before, we really got a lot done with that dry erase board. But more importantly,
it's kind of like saying Godzilla is a greater threat to humanity than Mothra. Millions of people die when they fight each other. It doesn't really matter which is worse.
Yeah, there's no protagonist. You know, I think that was the point that I was trying to make.
Mm.
So that takes us to through number two. And we're on to number three, which I think is an important one. And this has to do more with the argumentation. And
do you feel like
the rhetoric,
like before number two or after number two, there should be a definition of terms section, or is that something that needs to take place throughout?
That's a good question. And I think that fits in better to number four, the foundation of facts, because language is a big part of that. And definitions being clear is a very big part of that. And remember, you go over all of this before the debate even begins. But we are going to do an after show, and because we're not going to finish everything that I want to cover tonight, we are going to continue this discussion at schoolsucksproject.com/live. You can watch us there on Ustream. But when we went to the break, we were just beginning number three, and that was avoiding the box. Clause number three, avoiding the box. We are, just so you know, going over a political debate contract, a new idea that I'm toying with that I think eventually could become a practical tool for controlling the insanity that is so common in political discussions. So number three, avoiding the box. While the discussion must stay on the agreed upon topic, all parties must agree to abstain from the tactic of putting their opponents in a box. This refers to attempts to control the context of the discussion in a way that is advantageous to you. So examples of this are lifeboat scenarios. How do we describe that? What's a good definition for lifeboat?
Well, I mean, the classic lifeboat scenario is that, you know, you are in a lifeboat with 10 other people and there's not enough food or water for everybody. And the only way for anybody to survive is for somebody to get eaten.
Yeah. So the example that Peg Luxick gave in the Who Controls Our Children talk,
right. Mm-hmm.
Where she says, I know my way out of the lifeboat because they're creating a situation where I have to come to the outcome that they want, where one person drowns or gets eaten by a shark. So they have controlled the box. That's actually where I took the name from that Peg Luxick talk, in the box, putting somebody in the box, just like both political parties are. Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama.
Right.
Bad guys win.
They create a situation where you either have to volunteer to sacrifice yourself or you have to volunteer to sacrifice someone else against their will.
Exactly. So sacrifice is the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be that way. If you don't put a person in that box, the opportunity for possible solutions to that problem grows exponentially very quickly.
Well, it's not necessarily about sacrifice necessarily, but they create a situation where they put you in a conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
Where they really only leave you two ways out of the situation. And either way, it's a trap.
Between the rock and the hard place. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a lot of intellectual laziness, too.
Right.
Right. The whole political thing is, how will the government solve this problem? Right.
Right.
Or that's, I guess that's more of a liberal thing in some respects, unless you're talking about killing or terrorizing some group of brown people. How will the government do this thing? Right. So, in the end, the government does this thing. So what you do right at that point is preclude the discussion about all kinds of creative solutions to that problem by saying this or that, either or. It's also
right.
it's the either or is also a logical fallacy of saying it either has to be this or that. There's
right.
no middle ground. There's no way to expand this.
Black and white thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's the box. And people will try to do this to get outcomes from the other person that they want. How do I know this? Because I've done it. Because at times, you know, and I'm not proud of this, even though one, I really
took someone down exactly like the path that I wanted them to go for 20 minutes and thought at the time it was quite an accomplishment. And actually made a podcast about it, and I'm kind of actually making a video about it right now. Hmm. But that's for entertainment purposes. It was not an honest debate tactic. We're going to talk about that one in a second.
With all of these dishonest tactics, there's always the corollary honest tactic, right? So you can reduce irrelevant options to try to distill, get where you're trying to go rather than reducing the relevant options.
Yeah.
In economics, we always talk about Robinson Crusoe on the island, right? To just kind of get at core economic principles of trading, you know, savings and
starting
and
point,
consumption.
Yeah. Yeah. A priori right action before it gets clouded with all of these. Mm. I was trying to describe Keynesian economics and link it to the Ptolemaic model of the solar system. With the video that you guys made, Osborne, with Stefan Molyneux, about how to justify the idea that the Earth was the center of the solar system, you had to come up with these increasingly complex and convoluted mathematical models to keep trying to prove the same crazy thing because it was wrong. Mm-hmm. And Keynesianism is kind of the same way. Like, they're very good at crafting these very abstruse, complex models in justification of what is wrong, when maybe your school of thought in economics is more about, like, let's go back to basics and talk about the things that would be. Like,
well, if you've got a model that produces an incorrect result,
yeah,
you need to drill down and find where that assumption is that they made that was wrong.
Exactly.
I think there's a secondary benefit to making it so convoluted, and that is just convince people that they could never possibly understand it, and they should just leave it in the experts' hands.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. And we're certainly, oh my goodness, welcome to school, huh?
Yeah.
Jeez. Good point, Corey. Another example is the straw man fallacy. This is a little bit different than the lifeboat scenario, but it's the same idea of trying to control the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
A straw man is where you restate the person's argument in such a reductive way,
right,
that makes it sound simplistic and stupid and crazy. So, like, no one could defend it, right? So, like, if I talk about a voluntary society for 5 to 7 minutes, and then the person that I'm talking to turns to everybody else and says, this guy has no respect for this country. He wants to tear the country apart. He has straw-manned my argument.
Right.
Because who is going to get behind me? The guy who has no respect and wants to tear things apart. I'm violent and disrespectful.
Well, yeah, there was the guy who kept reducing my entire argument to this is, and this was an actual conversation I had, like, continually kept reducing my entire argument to, oh, you just want to do whatever you want. You just don't want anybody telling you what to do.
Right.
Which is, accurate to a certain extent, but not the way he made it sound.
You want to live in a world where everyone rides around on motorcycles with leather jackets and machine guns.
Exactly. Yeah. Like the argument from Catastrophe.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like,
it's going to be Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome without the government.
So that's the appeal to fear. That's the slippery slope. There's all kinds of logical fallacies that can be inserted once a straw man begins.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, loaded questions or trap setting. So a loaded question is asking questions that kind of steer the person where you want to go. Trap setting is a term that I use. And right now, making a video, I don't want to say it's insincere, but somebody could certainly poke logical holes in it, and it's more just for entertainment purposes. And it's based on a podcast I did called The Natural State. And at the end of this, I catastrophize against my ideas and ask the questions, what if the government disappeared tomorrow?
Mm.
Step by step, situation by situation, what would produce the worst possible outcome for the greatest number of people? And what would it look like if Murphy's Law went into effect, we wake up tomorrow and government is gone? And 10 steps later, we live in a world that's very similar to the one we live today.
If we woke up tomorrow and government was gone, wouldn't people immediately begin organizing elections for the replacement government?
No. Worst case scenario.
Oh, okay.
So the worst case scenario, my assertion was, and I believe this, is that maybe it would take a century, but we would be right where we are today. The worst case scenario of complete anarchy is our current society.
And that's the show. We live in the worst case scenario
of anarchy
right now today.
We are going to continue at schoolsucksproject.com/live. We got a lot more show to do because we are not done with this topic. So if you want to continue listening, please join us there.
Thanks for sticking with us. We're just getting started again in not quite the after show yet. But if you're just joining us for the after show, which some people actually do, I guess. We were going
There's no accounting for taste.
We were going over something called the political debate contract. Where do we leave off?
Right before clause number four, I think.
Oh, we were talking about.
We didn't talk about the special pleading fallacy.
Oh, and had we finished trap setting?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I was talking about how I was making this video where it leads us back to the state, and that's where the show ended. I'm talking through this just for editing purposes in the podcast. So I put that in there because I wanted this to be fair, right? Like, I don't want to just make a contract trying to stop everybody from the things that they do in their Republican/Democrat arguments.
Right.
I am trying to make a concerted effort, even though this is a little jabby at the political people. I do use a lot of tactics that are not from a rhetorical or logical standpoint, always entirely sincere. So the loaded questions trap setting has been one of my tactics, where Republicans and Democrats, God bless them, they're very predictable, you know? Mm. And you can push them into places by asking leading questions. And it's something that if you want honesty from them in a debate, I think that you should they should be reciprocating what you're doing. So that was number three, loaded questions. Number four, the special pleading fallacy, which is what I also call the retreat. And this is more for the political folks. And this is where when they make a claim, and I guess it could happen to us too, and it's proven to be false or just untenable, illogical, it's inconsistent with something else, they just move the goalposts.
Mm.
And they say, well, no, what I really meant was this. So an argument will begin. And you'll say, this government thing is bad. This government program, this government project, this action, this initiation of force is bad. And they'll be very upfront and on their toes at the start of this argument, and they'll say, you're crazy. That's good. And if you chip away at the that's good argument, maybe it takes 5 minutes, maybe it takes 2 hours, maybe with something like slavery, it takes 200 years, then they will dig in at a new position. They will retreat to, well, if it's not, it might not be good, but it's necessary. So they've gone from this moral argument to it's a practical argument. But when those arguments collapse, the final retreat, and this usually happens in the shorter political conversations, is, well, hey, man, that's the way it is. Or, yeah. Oh, you don't like it? Well, you should run for office.
Or you should move to another country.
Or you should move to another country, which is the adult version of I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. If you don't like it, get out.
Right. Well, it's like telling a slave to move to a different plantation.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. There's no place on earth you can go. And that was the...
No, there's Somalia.
And Antarctica. Right. Okay, so that was number three. Number four is the... clause number four in the political debate contract is foundation of facts. All parties must be able to determine that their opinion, claim, or call to action is built upon a foundation of facts with which their opponent agrees. This is often the most challenging part of any debate because each party will have different strengths and deficits in his or her knowledge base. Both parties will agree to fact-checking in real time, aka the internet, if necessary. Now, I've had conversations, I don't know about you guys, where I pull out my phone or I grab a laptop and I say, let's investigate.
I just have a little sign I hold up that says citation needed.
yeah, but exactly. But it's real easy to do with statistics. It is important, though, that there's an agreement here and language. This is what we were talking about earlier in the show, that Osborne brought this up, that language and definitions fits into this part of the discussion that, mm-hmm. like, if you say a word, we have to agree on
what that word means. And the most famous example is we use we for groups of which we are not a part.
Mm.
So when somebody says something like...
We beat the 49ers.
Well, yeah, it's very big in sports, but it's really big in talking about government.
We bombed Hiroshima.
Okay, sure, sure. So by we bombed Hiroshima, do you mean me and you? Or do you mean that was a decision made by a bunch of unelected military advisors talking to a president that neither of us voted for behind the closed doors of a room that you and I were not in? Is that what you mean by we?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I really am kind of wondering if this is a good use of my time taking this conversation forward if you can't use simple pronouns correctly.
How can it be we when my parents were toddlers at the time?
So definitions are very important. And we mentioned Steph a lot in the show tonight. We started reading one of his articles, what was it called? The Handout for Status.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a great speech at Porkfest a couple of years ago where he called, it was called Language, the Most Effective Government Program.
Mm-hmm.
And by program, it was programming, right? Like, our thoughts become our words, right? But our words often eventually turn into our thoughts if we keep using things over and over and over again. Anything else on facts that you think is important?
I try to stay away from them. They tend to get in the way.
Everything that you say that, everything that you assert as a fact is like a new place for a disagreement to occur.
Right.
So, well, I don't agree with your facts, or I have some facts about your facts, or I have some statistics about your statistics, you know, that kind of thing. The two ways to simplify these kinds of arguments. Now, this I like to think that what we've developed here is a pretty comprehensive approach that deals with all of it. But the one way is to look at the other person's argumentation, more specifically, their logic and their rhetoric. If there are just inconsistencies and logical fallacies all over the place, you've identified that their position is untenable or they really just don't have a leg to stand on. But if they also reject moral principles, like first principles, like the non-aggression principle, and it, like you say, these are the things we need to agree on. And from there, like the rest of this stuff should kind of sort itself out. If those two things aren't in place, like bickering about little factoids is not really important, and you're probably not having a very productive debate.
Right.
Number five, ideological flexibility. If you agree that your opponent can clearly demonstrate that your argument contains numerous inconsistencies, contradictions, or other general errors in reasoning, you will follow up by doing all of the following. Number one, avoid launching into an emotion-driven invective against your opponent, including ad hominem attacks, aka fight. Number two, avoid the taking my ball and going home tactic where you say something like, I've had it with this. There's no talking to you and everyone is entitled to their opinion anyway. Goodbye. AKA or, flight.
We need to agree to disagree.
Oh, yeah.
That's another one.
Yeah, that's a great way to stop a potentially meaningful discussion. Because it's getting kind of uncomfortable, right? Well, we're all entitled to our opinions. You know, we agree to disagree, right? Like all opinions are created equal because people have them.
Well, this is why they say you shouldn't just talk to people about politics.
Well, yeah, and that's what I explain that to you know, kids in the SAT class all the time when we talk about persuasive writing. I say, you know, we say these nice kinds of things like everyone's entitled to their opinion, but not all our opinions are equal, you know?
Right.
If, you know, I'm a astrophysicist and a geologist and I'm debating a guy who's got a hat on made out of tinfoil claims that the earth is hollow and aliens live in it, those are not equal opinions because they don't, one is much higher up as far as it's the foundation of facts that are underneath it.
Right. I think we've been trained by the media to automatically assume there's always two sides to every story and not every story has two sides.
No, absolutely not. And some have more than two sides.
And the media actually goes overboard on what, you know, what they refer to as balance, you know, by showing two sides to every story. And there is a law on the internet. They call it Skarka's law that says there is no position so vile that you can't find somebody who will defend it. And that's a lot of times what you end up resorting to when you're determined to show both sides of every story.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Fox News was famous for that, where they'd find, you know, some really wacky far out left winger. And they'd say, well, there's the view from the other side. You know, well, we don't say we don't have these people on. But that, yeah, that's
or,
a good point.
Or they get the person that plays the other side that's not really.
Yeah.
Like, who's that? Kirsten Powers they have on all the time.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't sound like a liberal. She claims she's a liberal, but like.
Yeah.
She doesn't do anything. Or even Juan Williams. I mean, he.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And like, at the end of the day, what's the difference anyway?
Yeah.
So that was number two. Number three, admit that your position needs additional research and consideration. So this is the follow-up. If your argument can be exposed as fallacious or having significant inconsistencies, these are the things you must do. Number three, admit that your position needs additional research and consideration. Number four, agree to consume two pieces of educational media chosen for you by your opponent, i.e. articles, book excerpts, videos, podcasts, etc. And that is the debate contract that we can hand to people who are on the typical left or typical right if they want to debate us on our positions. Now, we have for the last 2 hours, we've gone over a draft of this, and I encourage people to take it. I'll put it up in the show notes for this. I'll put a PDF of it on, or I'll try to get it as a Word document. Take it, copy it, paste it, change it, simplify it. That was one of your criticisms, Osborne, was the mechanics of it, right? You said it was a little bit clunky, maybe?
Yeah, a little bit too much. I mean, it's like when you meet a nice young lady at the drinking establishment and take her home with you. You don't pull out your AIDS test results and have them, you know, properly initialed and sign a contract about
you don't,
what happens the next day.
You don't have to establish a mutually agreed upon definition of orgasm.
Here's,
you know,
here's the way I'm going to insert my penis into you. Those kind of things.
Yeah.
Right. It just kind of happens.
We made it a half an hour into the after show before the word penis came up. I think that's a record of some kind.
Yeah, you just have sloppy, drunken fucking, which is what most of these debates are. Okay,
which is what they resemble.
So that's the problem.
There's a lot of
where everybody gets crabs, right?
That problem is not solved by.
And there's a lot of leg cramps and gasping for air,
and
crying.
And then the next day, you say, oh, "Why did I do that?" Ugh.
Well, I think if you look at how the GOP has handled this latest thing with the RNC. If that's any indication of how people of the right will debate you, it's that they will change the rules to win.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of individuals, it's more identifying your opponent than anything. Identifying if they're coming at you with simple facts because they don't
have. Oh, wait, hold on. Everyone stop. We lost our connection.
No.
All right. Can you, JJ, can you start at the beginning of where you were?
Well, basically what I'm trying to say is that over the course of these few years, I've had a lot of debates with people who are very statist.
Yeah.
Most recently, it was at the festival in Keene, the Cheshire County Festival. And identifying your opponent, identifying where this individual, not opponent in a bad way, but the other person, identifying this individual and where they're coming from is key to understanding how the debate is going to unfold. Now, like the GOP changes rules. I mean, that kind of sets a precedent for people who are right-wingers. They're going to change the rules of the debate to suit their fancy or their position, whatever it may be. I think also coming at people with emotional argument, if someone presents you with emotional argument, you can present them with, like, say someone says to you, well, do you want the terrorists to win? And I'm like, well, do you want to keep killing babies and women? So I'm going to come right back. And you're going to have to stand up to the same thing. No,
but don't you think it's better to like just try to steer that back towards, like, let's get our definitions straightened out, like, who are the terrorists? Define winning.
That's not realistic, though. That's not going to happen on the street. You're talking about a debate on a stage that's been prepared with a moderator. But I'm talking about convincing people on the street or convincing people that you just have a conversation with the clerk at a gas station. You don't have time for all that. What you do is you hit them with your core arguments. If they're coming at you from an emotional standpoint, then perhaps an emotional argument will work best with this individual. So you come at them with an emotional argument. Like, I've only got 30 seconds before you got to get to the next person. So all I'm going to say is this. Okay. I vote for Ron Paul because I want to end the wars and killing of innocent women and children. And then I leave.
Right.
That's hard to argue with.
That's it. I mean, I'd leave him with a core idea because honestly, a lot of people don't have time to digest complicated arguments.
And nor do they want to. And it's also kind of a liability for them to do that.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Now, how do you guys feel about this? If a person is just obfuscating and totally irrational, not having any kind of sincere information exchange, these people exist. But there's people watching this. I hate to use this kind of elitist language, but they really make an excellent prop.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, okay, so you're in favor of that, JJ.
I definitely use that as an opportunity to, I know whatever I say to this person is irrelevant. So at that point, I'm speaking to the people that are listening. And this has happened in bars. I open carry at a bar in Keenan. This guy has this, he hates open carrying people. And so I sit there and why do you not like this situation? You know, what is it about it that upsets you? And I eventually did convince him to like me, but it was the guy sitting next to him that was actually rooting for me at some point. He actually started with like, dude, you're drunk. This guy is cool. He's not going to do anything. You're overreacting. You know, after like a couple minutes into it, I'm playing. As soon as I realize that this guy is not capable of cognitive sort of function at this point, mm-hmm. I'm talking to the guy next to him, and that guy's helping me out. But I'm talking through this guy. So it's identifying your situation, identifying how, as you said, prop is great because maybe I don't convince this person, but his friend for 50 years sitting next to him is going to convince him. And I just need to get to that friend through him. In my experience, when people confront you about your beliefs, it's because they have some cognitive disorder with the argument you made. They cannot accept that the state would hurt innocent people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They believe that whoever the state goes after is guilty of something. They have right. to be. And then when you confront them with this argument, this logical, factual argument that the state does in fact harm innocent people, they have to basically start expanding the illusion of their belief system, this mythology that the state, the religion of the state, if you will, they have to expand this to encompass your argument and to sort of wall it off from their intelligence because it'll destroy their illusions.
Yeah, we talked about this during the regular show and like maybe even having some empathy. I mean, like, and it sounds like you do. Certainly you have some understanding for that because we've all up in our personal lives, right? And we've all thought and acted emotionally in our personal lives. And we've all been in these situations where it was easier not to confront something in our personal lives. But I found like one of my criticisms of my approach personally in the past has been I'd be so ready to be a hypocrite about it when it comes to some political issue for somebody, you know, like, don't you see, you know, you're blinding yourself. You're in denial, you know, like, those are things that I think a lot of us can understand, can identify with. And when you see what's at stake, I mean, what you're talking about is like what's really at stake for people in these discussions. I think that what we've tried to lay out here is a way that I totally get what you're saying, that this is like what you said, Osborne, that this is clunky. And you're saying that this most people just won't work like this. Then they're probably not good candidates.
Listen, if you don't hear what you can tell us, if it's good, you can tell us so.